Well, I love that sound. Welcome back. We're beginning our final hour of Larsel in Action. And on this third hour, we're going to be talking about International Megan's Law. Primarily, I'm sure we'll get some other, we'll get somebody who wants to talk about something else, but we're going to talk about bulk of the hour in International Megan's Law. For the final hour, I want to welcome our special guest. You've already heard from King Alexander. We're going to have King Alexander for this hour and Paul Rigney from the Registrant Travel Action Group. And King Alexander is an attorney in the state of Louisiana, and he's a supervising attorney in the Calcasieu Parish Public Defender's Office, which is in Lake Charles. He's licensed in Texas and California. And we put this segment together because of the recent dismissal of the IML challenge that was filed by Axel and Janice Bellucci. This is the second lawsuit that's been dismissed, which indicates that the challenges raised thus far have not been viewed very favorably by two different federal judges. We plan to briefly discuss the most recent dismissal as well as strategies going forward. But before I do that, I'd like to read a very brief part of a statement that NARSL has issued. And it's not going to take me but a minute, but we don't do a lot of reading here. NARSL reiterates the previous statement, quote, "It's beneath the dignity of the United States to brand its own citizens with a mark of derision and shame, a mark that will likely close a great many borders to our citizens, or even worse, subject them to physical and emotional harm in a foreign land. And it's for this reason NARSL remains steadfast in its opposition to key provisions of IML," end of quote. NARSL's board of directors was concerned when the initial challenge was filed that challenge was premature. And we said that at the time that there were too many unknowns to make the challenge go forward with much chance of success. We thought it was imprudent. And then at the second lawsuit, NARSL had concerns about the second lawsuit, but it went forward anyway, and it met with the same demise. NARSL believes that the time is right to move forward now with a limited, indeed very surgical, constitutional challenge to IML containing only claims that are likely to be found meritorious. To that end, NARSL has assembled a team of attorneys and professionals and entrusted them with determining the best strategy. They have recommended attacking one key provision of IML, which we're going to talk about a little bit as this program unfolds. But we try our best at NARSL not to mislead people, to get people's hopes up, and we try to stay away from just saying things that people want to hear. We made the statement at the time that we vehemently disagreed with this law, that it was not going to be effective to achieve any type of public good. But just because you don't like something doesn't render it unconstitutional. And that's another thing that I have said repeatedly, that public policies are not necessarily, bad public policy is not necessarily unconstitutional. So welcome Paul Rigney, and welcome King Alexander, although you've been participating off and on previously through this broadcast. How are you, sir? Mr. Rigney, how are you?
Thank you, Larry. I'm doing great.
So, Mr. Alexander, glad to have you with us this evening. We've been together a lot recently on the Registry Matters podcast. How are you?
It's a pleasure to be here. I'm good. Thanks for having me.
So, all right. Well, this segment will be alternating between Andy and I, and Andy has the first shot.
Hey, Paul, this is Andy. I don't know if you remember. We've met at the conference a couple years in a row. But for
yes,
anybody...
I do.
Good. And thanks for joining us. For the new people that are on the call, could you describe a little bit of background of IML?
This is for me, Paul. Yes.
Yeah.
About 2007-2008, Congressman Smith from New Jersey started trying to get out of committee, I think it was the judiciary, a Megan's Law that applied internationally that would provide an alert to countries when a sex offender against a minor was traveling. And in accordance with that, the Homeland Defense had set up an angel watch office within Immigration, Customs, and Enforcement, ICE, that would do just that. And it would get its information from the Marshal Service and from manifests, from flight records, from the flight system as that's released to the Border Patrol. As it pressed through, there was some notional information that that powers to be were not going to let it get out of committee. But in 2016, enough people got into the committee and allowed it to get out of committee. As everything that has a sex offender stamp on it, no one votes against it, so the law was passed. The problem with the current law was it took a kind of Frankenstein element that was not in the original bill. The original bill was they would only send alerts if people were traveling and the Angel Watch office could assess that they were traveling to exploit children or to travel with children. And then the other case was that it would abide by the SORNA regulations as far as who had to register. The law that came out, they decided to three things that changed. They decided to send alerts to all countries for anyone who has an offense against a minor if you have to register where you live. They would not make any effort to decide the purpose of your travel. The third thing was they were supposed to notify us if they had sent the alert via text, email, or phone. That was taken out. And the most chilling part was they decided to add a unique identifier to passports of those people whose offense is against a child who must register where they live. So those are the current aspects of the International Magnitsky Law. It was passed January of last year. It went into full effect October of this year, and now people have been receiving spurious letters saying that the passports will be revoked and that they have to get a new passport with the new stamp. We suspect this will take a long time to take effect, and many people have gone literally within the last 3 months, gotten a new passport without the stamp and traveled on that new passport. So the passport identifier is being rolled out at a very slow pace, and it's difficult to understand if and when you may get that letter from the State Department. And the last part of it is that you must give 21-day notice to the place that you must register before you travel, and that's for all sex offenders who must register, before you travel internationally. So those are the major aspects of international Magnitsky Law.
Thank you for that. Larry,
if any of that makes sense.
Well, what is your organization you're representing? Just to clear, bring people up to speed. What is RTAG? Well, what is Registered Travel Action Group?
Registered Travel Action Group was created about 2.5-3 years ago, initially to just help people travel, to understand international Magnitsky Law, have a place where they can input their information as to what their experience is when they travel, and then we've developed a matrix. That I keep up to date all the time. For example, I think right now it says it's up to date June, but it is really up to date as of today. It gives indications of those countries who have turned registrants away. Now, the problem with that data is that there's a lot of people that either haven't put information into my database or there are some people that have actually been allowed to enter a country. So what we decided to do is just keep it a very generic list to at least give people some initial information as to how they can travel and where they can travel to. We've gathered hundreds of information about people's travel experiences, and we have that database available for future efforts, whether it's to help people travel, which I use all the time, or whether it's for lawsuits. And then the final thing we do is, and I do this probably 3 or 4 times a week, is I talk to people individually on where they're traveling to and help them best try to travel safely and get into the country without being turned away, or at least help them get through the process of where they can travel for a honeymoon or an anniversary or whatever the case may be. The next step, though, is, and I'll elaborate that some further, we're now going to go to the next step where we're going to engage the countries and the human rights organizations to try to do what we can to tear down the effects of international negligence law. And I'll go into that more detail as we go on with the conversation.
There have been reports received that citizens have been notified that their passports have been canceled due to a provision contained in IML. What advice do you guys have at RTAG for those wondering if their passport is valid?
Yep. We recommend, and there's, like everything, there's caveats, but we recommend that if you have a valid passport, do two things. One, travel on that valid passport and don't turn it into the State Department. And do not contact the State Department to ask them if your passport is still valid. Let me disregard that. Don't call the State Department saying, hey, I need a new passport with a stamp on it. Let the State Department do that. We suspect they're behind the power curve. You want to keep that passport in your hands as long as you can. So don't give them heads up that you want, hey, give me a new passport because I don't feel confident when I travel. Because at any time, and people have been stuck overseas, and I'll tell you in a minute how to deal with that, but there have been individuals stuck overseas with a passport that's been revoked, which is really chilling, but there's a way to work through that. What we recommend very specifically is if your passport's good, travel on that passport, check your mail before you travel. And before you travel, you can contact the State Department or any embassy to just check and see if your passport is valid. If your passport's valid, don't worry about it. Just travel. And if you get the letter will state that the passport that you have is owned by the State Department. You're expected to return that immediately and then go get a new passport. I recommend go ahead and get a new passport. I personally, this is just me, I would keep my old passport and just throw it in a file, because if you travel overseas and you're able to get to a country and you have to, for example, check into a hotel, guess what? They're going to want to see your passport. And we've already had one example of someone who a hotel noticed the statement in the very back page. I don't know why they looked at it, but the person had explained to the restaurant owner or the hotel owner that it was no big deal, and they said, okay, that's fine. We don't care about it. Your country's insane. You can stay at our hotel. But that puts people at risk. So I would be traveling with my new passport with the stamp and my old passport if I can. Even though they say – I don't know the legality of that, but you know, it's my hide or the hide of my family that I'm traveling with. I'm going to keep my family safe. You know, if they confiscate the old passport when I come back through customs, that's just the way it is. I'll just say, oh, I forgot I had it, whatever. But that's what we recommend. Keep your old passport and keep it as long as you can until the government tells you to get a new one.
So this one's for King. Apparently, Congress delegated to the State Department the authority to cancel existing passports. Is cancellation of passports something that Congress can properly delegate to the executive branch? Isn't that what the Gundy case is kind of about before the U.S. Supreme Court right now?
It is a sore spot because we have separation of powers. There's no separation of powers clause. That's actually a structural argument, constitutionally speaking. But it really chafes to see the extent to which the legislative department delegates massive amounts of its authority to the executive in these varied departments, various departments that have unelected people and bureaucracies, and they're there and have learned over time not to really have to be very responsive to people. And that's part of what we're probably, as far as what the Gundy case is about, that's before the Supreme Court now. I'm not knowledgeable about that to be able to comment on that. Maybe Paul can help us with that.
It's a non-delegation argument as well about the Adam Walsh Act, but that's all right. But delegation of authority is quite common. They'll make a broad law and then they'll say, you people figure out how to do it at the executive branch. And I was driving at a point is who you have in the executive branch determines how they figure the, how they figure it out, depending on the temperature level of the particular executive and who they appoint to make these decisions and how far down it goes in the bureaucracy, or the reverse, how far up the bureaucracy, the delegation may be, you make it as tough on these SOBs as you can. It's kind of like I get a lot of criticism here in my state about when I tell people that the reason why I don't have any pardons from the executive branch, because this executive doesn't believe that anybody can ever reform. The reason why we have tough supervision of sexual oriented offenders is because this executive branch, who appoints the people, they decide that they want to be harsh and have a zero tolerance policy. Well,
and we see a lot of that. And it's, as a practical matter, Congress isn't going to act every time the federal government needs to cancel someone's passport. So there is room for delegation there, but it can go too far.
Yes, and the enthusiasm by which an administration is going to do something depends on how that administration views life, and that's what I was headed for. Okay, Andy.
All right, and Paul, going back to the answer you just gave about traveling with, you know, carrying two essentially, haven't people tried to travel and then they get turned away because their passport was expired? Wouldn't they have been notified? Wasn't there some sort of statute that said that they should be notified before their passport got canceled?
Yeah. The way the law is written is that there, before the passports to be revoked, they are supposed to – State Department is required to send them a letter stating that the passport's supposed to, it will be revoked and that they need to come in and get a new one if that's what they choose to do. But again, people have I had one individual who traveled to Italy, met a woman he had dated for a while. He's now getting married, and actually he's married now, and Italy's going to give him residency. He got a letter that why he was had traveled. Of course, he was there for a while. They'd given 21-day notice, and they sent the letter and revoked his passport after he left. So he went through the process in Italy of getting a new passport. And I believe I'll have to follow up. I'm not sure. I think he'll probably have the stamp on it. But he's able to get a new passport in Italy. But he was technically an undocumented alien with a revoked passport in a foreign country. And that's the challenge. And the only word we have from the State Department of what to do is if you travel and you're overseas to check. All they don't tell you if they're going to notify you. They just – you need to call the consulate or the embassy to check before you travel back whether your passport's good. And what they'll do is you have to travel to the consulate or the embassy and get some type of card or something that will allow you to return to the United States in lieu of the fact that your passport's been revoked. So, of course, I mean, who knows to do that? Nobody. So that's what my organization is trying to help people with as they travel and get that word out. You know, the whole process is very, very, very chilling and annoying. They've given us no way to really back us up as we travel, which is kind of very scary. Anyway,
King, on that point about the they people think they've got a valid passport. They renewed it a year ago, and it's good for 10 years. And they try to travel, and then they've spent hundreds and sometimes thousands on a trip, and they make it all the way to their foreign destination, or even don't even make it. But anyway, they get interrupted, and they thought they had a valid passport. They weren't notified that you need to bring this thing in. We've heard reports that that's in fact happened. Would that person have a conceivable cause of action that might be viable enough to survive the first motion to dismiss?
I think that's doubtful. I would defer to maybe what Paul would say, but I can tell you that any claim against the federal government is not under regular tort law. You have to bring it. It's federal. It's under the Federal Tort Claims Act. And as you might imagine, the federal government tends to treat itself very well. in terms of this type of administrative thing and having civil liability for it. If the person who to whom the passport was issued could have exercised some diligence by, for instance, as Paula suggested, calling to see if the passport is valid before embarking on the trip, so then they would kind of, in tort terms, that would be called last clear chance. It's a way of kind of shifting the blame to the person who was injured. And there's that. But Paul mentioned people who actually have traveled on a passport that was valid, got to their destination, and then only to have it canceled while they were there. And that I didn't take it to mean that that was done intentionally while the person was overseas, although if all the dots were connected, the government should know that the passport was used and visas were issued and that sort of thing. But it's probably just one hand not knowing what the other is doing. And he described a procedure for contacting the embassy or the consulate and getting it straightened out for travel back. But as far as people having to cancel vacations and that sort of thing, I don't know. I think it would be a good idea to get travel insurance, and I see an opportunity for someone who writes travel insurance to make some money doing this. I don't know whether that's should be a brand new thing. And how they would rate that.
Well, it wouldn't be too long till they put an exclusion in for that. If they started paying claims for people, they'd find a way to exclude that.
Well, they can either exclude it or they can rate it in such a way that they can make money on it, you know, but they have to take the risk into consideration.
Go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, the rating would be important. People have claims to some this is just notional data, to some degree of success on the travel insurance. What concerns me is that if we're a registrant and the insurance companies find out, they may choose simply not to give us any insurance because the risk is too high, unless they rate it as a separate type of insurance, which might be advisable and would be a benefit to them. But at the moment, I mean, people have not insurance, and I think that's a good way to give yourself you know, a cushion or safety. My emphasis is try to get it to where people don't have to get, I mean, they don't have to execute the insurance. They can travel and actually get someplace and go on with their trip without being molested. That's where I want to get to. And I want to give them as much information as they can to travel where they think they can without having to lose a vacation or take the government to court. The problem with any court case against the government on a civil side is most of the situations are going to be, you know, by the time they're damaged, they've already fixed it. If someone's overseas, the passport's revoked and their vacation's destroyed. For example, if I'm in Europe, I want to travel to someplace else and my passport's been revoked. If I exit any country, then I could get turned away at the country just because my passport's no longer good. Or I may not be able to board my flight. What does that do for someone who has a trip to Europe and then a business trip to the Middle East? Because, you know, you can get into some Middle Eastern countries, Lebanon, for example, Israel. If I own a company and my company's taking me to that, I'm an example where we might have business in Israel. I go to Europe for a meeting, then I go to Israel. My passport's been revoked. It screws up my meeting. Then I, you know, what do I do? I'm screwed. And then I want to sue the government. I mean, I've already fixed the problem by the time I get around to trying to get compensation from the government. And that's the biggest challenge, is all of this will happen after people have been damaged. And that's one of the biggest
problems. And some damages are difficult to quantify too. I mean, to the extent that you've wasted the expense of air travel, accommodations, that sort of thing is good. But for the personal enjoyment of a vacation and the other intangible benefits of travel, it's hard to get compensation for. So it's really litigation is not very satisfactory.
Well,
I don't really see it. go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I had another question. But if you guys are going to dialogue, please go ahead.
Well, my thought is that, I want litigation that will get meat on the problem and not just deal with someone's loss of. So, for example, the right to marriage, I think we can, and I know we're going to be talking about litigation later, but right to marriage can get us some traction. Due process, which is a human right, which all countries have signed up for, can get us traction. So there's other things that can get us traction. And at the end of the day, if someone loses a vacation trip because of IML, then the government would probably turn around and say, well, travel someplace where you don't get turned away, so it's not going to bring any relief that can give us traction to eat away at the provisions of IML. And that's kind of where I want to focus, except I do want to help people travel. And if people want advice and insurance, I certainly want to give them that advice. But I want to try to get our efforts on areas that can nibble away slowly at IML, at least so people can travel to as many countries as possible without having their vacations destroyed. Anyway.
That's fine. Is there explicitly statutory language contained in IML that prohibits a person from traveling overseas?
No, and it's very interesting how they wrote IML. Government's response to that question is there's no aspect of IML that at all limits, in its wording, the ability of American citizens registrants to travel internationally. And the government states that all they're doing is providing information, which is open source, an issue of a country's security. So they're providing open source information to the country for them to make decisions that they may choose to take based upon the person's status as a registrant. I would argue that there's a legal status, and I don't know what the term is, but if a law by fact limits the person's ability to travel by the very application of the law, then in effect it does limit a person's ability to travel internationally. Of course, I'm not a lawyer, and at the moment I believe a lot of lawyers who are in the community, including Larry's background, would tell me that won't fly, and it's probably true. But in fact, the law as written does limit the ability of people to travel internationally. It just does by its application. That's just a fact.
And that is part of what I find interesting, and Larry and I have kicked this around a little bit, because there is a constitutional right to people of the United States, people in the United States, not even necessarily just citizens, to travel. And this arises from the Civil War Amendments. Civil War Amendments for 13 was emancipation, 14th is due process and several other things, and the 15th. And there is a right to travel and to move between the several states. And there is federal legislation that is empowered by that, the Travel Act. When you get to overseas, it gets a little bit murkier. Is there a right to travel? But the federal, there are other rights that have to do with commerce, and also the Privileges and Immunities Clause entails the right to pursue a profession. So if a person is in a line of work that requires them to do international travel, and this law is basically putting them out of business because they're in something that moves too quickly to always give the 21 days notice. In state registration law, I see real conundrums and real frustrating situations with that and with the interpretation of it. I would think there could be some fertile ground, or at least it's worth exploring to see what could be predicated on these rights.
So that was leading into my next question.
Let me make a statement on that, and this will add to what you just said. The alert system that they've created, which piggybacks the green notices from Interpol, originally they stated this person's going to arrive and they're going to do something bad, nefarious in your country. Well, they stopped doing that, and all they do is they send a message stating that this individual was convicted of this offense on this date. We're just letting you know. Well, the problem with that is that internationally, especially since 9/11, the alert system that we've created between countries is specifically meant, or at least interpreted by the other countries, as a statement of alarm or criminal conduct or something of national security. So, in fact, I would argue that the very fact that they send a message via the system they're doing, they're sending an alert to countries, which prima facie is a statement of some nefarious intent. And in fact, the very fact that they send the message via the means that they do is a statement that this individual is dangerous. And the government stated that, well, we're not stating that. We're simply stating that this person was convicted of this on this date. Well, that's fine. It's a system that was created, but for the very fact of setting alerts that need to send between countries to alert them of problems, either criminal or terrorism or national security, that very fact is a state is limiting people's travel. And that's just a fact. That is a fact of the system they've created. And to me, that should be traction right there. I mean, they're not sending messages that someone had a DWI or someone punched his sister or a wife or someone robbed a bank. They're sending this information. And it is of derogatory information, which is creating concerns of the countries that arrive, telling them to send us home. And that in and of itself is prima facie derogatory.
That is very concerning. The no-fly list comes to mind.
I don't know. So I'll be quiet for a second.
Okay, well, I've just you've got me thinking, this is King, that the no-fly list comes to mind, and it's very notorious for its complete lack of due process, that they put somebody on the no-fly list just because somebody in law enforcement wants to. And this creates no end of problem for people who find that they can't fly. And certainly there are rights. But the reason why I'm looking for a right to predicate an action on is that the more fundamental it is, then the stricter is the scrutiny that's applied to any kind of a legal challenge. And clearly it's not the least restrictive means to go about
telling.
Can you
hang on for 1 second, King? We just lost.
Sure.
Hang on.
Well, if you can't be with your wife, then you're not married.
Unmuted.
If a law physically keeps you from being with your wife, then that law is keeping me from having my wife and my family. And that's a constitutional protection, and it's also human rights protection, which the U.S. government signed up to in the UNHCR documents in 1948. So if a law prima facie creates a situation, then that law should be either unconstitutional or violation of human rights. And that should be the same case with the alert system. If it keeps me from traveling, then it keeps me from traveling. That's just a thought.
That's right. And I'm seeing then that it does not pursue the least restrictive means. And it's a cop-out that they say that, well, we're just giving this public publicly available information. Well, they're doing it with its expectation that these countries may act on it, and they may not act on it rationally. But there's really nothing rational in any of the sex offender registration stuff. If they were only to give, it seems to me, the only thing that's justified to alert another country of is not the fact that someone had to be on a registry or was ever convicted of something, but that they are in fact objectively likely to commit some kind of crime in that other country. Now they may they probably have some cases. In reading the opinion on this dismissal, they talk about the number of people who have repeatedly engaged in sex tourism of the kind that, that targets underage people in the destination country. Now, if they could, they have that kind of information on someone and they are booking travel to a destination country for underage sex tourism, that seems like something that would be legitimate to notify the other country. But just that somebody is required by the ridiculous laws of the United States to be on a registry, or the fact that they, whether they have to be a registry or not, that they have ever been convicted of a registration offense, is not likely to have any relevance to anything except to interfere with someone's travel.
So King, I'm going to push back on you a little bit on this one. You know, hang on, Paul. I'm going to push back on that. Paul, hang on. I want to push back on this. You've just went down the rat hole that people go down. That's a public policy discussion there that you've tried to turn into a legal argument. Whether or not this is a good thing to do from a policy perspective, whether there could be a better way to do it, is not the same thing as being unconstitutional.
Well, my argument goes to the standard of review. If there is a right that is being impaired, then it has to be better than rational basis. You
well,
know,
I,
just,
I get,
just
I get,
your garden
I get,
variety.
I get that.
Policy is rational basis.
Whether the United States wants to participate with a group of nations who share information with one another and provide this, whether that's a costly or too costly, or whether it's more efficient, that's a policy discussion. And the people, when they elected the Congress that made this, they made a policy choice on behalf of the American people. That does not render it unconstitutional because you don't like a policy.
Well, if the policy is going to govern where we can go and what we can do and things that are said about us, it has to have a rational basis, even at the lowest standard of scrutiny.
And they have survived twice now, saying that it's the rational basis is sufficient. If we continue to try to have a policy discussion in the courts, we're not going to win. We're going to win with a legal argument, which is my next question.
And that's why I'm always looking for a right on which to predicate a higher standard of review.
So Narsil's legal team believes that a narrowly focused... Next question. Narsil's legal team believes that a narrowly focused challenge targeting the 21-day advance notice could possibly gain traction. If we do file the lawsuit, the government will clearly claim that they would never, ever prosecute a person that traveled due to a necessity that wasn't able to give the required notice. Doesn't this 21-day notice requirement serve to interfere? It doesn't, like a prior restraint, and it's based on a person, what they might do, because what they've done is over with. And America doesn't restrain people based on what they might do. What do you think about if we target that, which is where I've maintained from the very get-go of this, that's where we might gain traction. What do you think of that, King?
I like it because if their argument is, oh, we would never prosecute that, you know, then that's really no standard at all. In other words, they're saying just give us plenary power to do whatever we want and rely on our goodwill not to abuse it. And I've had, the occasion to say to legislative committee when complaining about these endless statutes of limitation and so on that are founded on the now thoroughly discredited repressed memory theory. One of the legislators on committee said, well, don't you think a good prosecutor is only going to prosecute a case that is good and is not going to, after I've complained that after so long, the witnesses are dead or gone, the whole landscape has changed, and they've made it impossible for someone to make out a defense if they let the case be prosecuted, 40 plus years after it's claimed to have happened. And my response was, there are always those who are willing to say, just give us more and more power. And we promise you that none of us will ever abuse any of it. Well, we know that's not how it really works. So I think there would be fault in that. I would have to research legally just how to attack it. But the idea that they say this requirement that you have a problem with, You shouldn't have a problem with it, because trust us just not to.
We can have some fun with the discovery on this. Okay, because they're going to say, trust us. And we're going to say, okay, please, the discovery process, give us your Department of Justice instructions to your however many attorney general's offices are around the country, U.S. attorney's offices. We're going to say, where are the policy directives? Of course, they don't have any. And then we're going to, if they do amazingly manufacture something, I don't think they have, then we're going to say, how have you communicated this to the registered community so that they will know what those exigent circumstances are that would permit them to travel without the fear of prosecution? Because they don't know about this, therefore they're in fear that they're going to go to prison for a very long time for not complying with this, and they can't do a legitimate business transaction, they can't do a family emergency. So you tell me how you have provided for this, and they can't do it because they haven't done it.
That's right, and there's a great chilling there. And usually what we find from dealing with all matters in registration and the contractors that they use to analyze the risk of people is nobody ever wants to find that there's no risk, because they're worried about their own civil and political liability for saying someone is okay for the bad thing not to happen. They always feel safer just to take the most restrictive position and not allow anybody to do anything, because if you do allow it and then something bad happens and it comes back on them. So I don't think they would be able to demonstrate that they were all that magnanimous in practice. But plus, and just the fact that there's no standard at all to that. I mean, if you read just what the law says, it says that they can prosecute. And so that is clearly, if you can find any right, such as travel, such as free association, I think was what Paul was talking about, that you have a right to be with your wife, your association, your familial family relations, all of those things. That is chilled when you are afraid to book the trip because of what they might be able to do.
Doesn't that introduce a First Amendment right then?
Yes, and the First Amendment has been pretty strong. Paul Dubling said that the only thing he got traction with his district judge in the Fourth Circuit was the First Amendment stuff. And then we just had the U.S. Supreme Court last year in Packingham versus North Carolina say that the First Amendment, it's not just speech, it's many things. It's freedom of religion, free association, petition of grievances, peaceable assembly, and all the things that pertain to the town square and the street. And the majority, it was a unanimous result, but the majority of the justices in Packingham said, well, and the internet today is like the town square and the street, and the four more conservative ones. So, well, wait a minute, we think you're going too far to say that. And then they said all these great things about the real town square and the real street. Well, I love that, because a lot of the cases that I see do involve the real public park, the square, and the real street versus the internet. And so I think that that is a powerful right that even conservative federal judges perk up and take an interest in.
Well, King, not only that, they were strong on the case about the which Gorsuch joined the liberals on the majority, which irritated some conservatives about the void for vagueness and the deportation for people on serious violent felonies. They said you have to define it, so it can't be arbitrarily. I mean, it was just a textbook case about void for vagueness. They've just recently have issued precedent. So if the government defends this lawsuit and says, well, just trust us, that's not going to fly. I think it shouldn't.
And that's encouraging that Gorsuch saw that, you know, and there's this knee-jerk favoring of the government, and then there's someone who is familiar with the legal doctrines and reads the law and say, well, this doesn't really pass muster of what the way a statute is supposed to be written.
So, Paul, you were trying to chime in here, and I wanted to get back to you before we move to the next series of questions. I wanted to make sure we got this out here about what our strategy is at NARSL, but go ahead.
Well, here's a thought. Okay, so you're an offender, you're against a minor, and you have to register where you reside. When you travel, the government may send an alert. The problem with that is, and I wonder if there's a due process issue here, some states I have to register, some states I don't. So if my offense, where I live, for example, in California, you're on the registry forever, except they did passed the law recently, but in Florida, you're on the registry forever. So if I live in Florida, forever, if I travel, an alert may be sent. But if I move to Utah, and which has a 10-year requirement, and you can move to Utah and they'll take you off if you're a low-level offender based upon your offense, they won't send a message because I no longer have to register. Where is that fair? Does that make any sense? To me, that's an unfair application of law based upon where I live. What sense does that make? Is there a due process?
That's an interesting. That's an interesting theory, Paul. So your argument would be that the registry, the variations of duration around the country. So a Vermonter who likely would have a 10-year registration obligation for a very similar conduct than in Florida where they'd have a lifetime. So you're saying that federal law is disproportionately affecting the Floridian versus the Vermonter, and how is exactly. doesn't that equal protection king? Is it? I like it, but I don't think it's going to go anywhere. But what do you see in it?
Yeah, equal protection works better if you're a member of a protected class, and being a registered person is like the opposite of a protected class. It's the open season class, and so I don't know that, but these problems of the lack of uniformity among the states has caused me, and I count myself a small government conservative, to begin to think about how its effect on interstate commerce and all these other federal rights of travel, and when you have these terrible conundrums because of the conflicts of laws among the states, that maybe this actually is an area in which the Commerce Clause, the federal power, would counsel toward preemption of the field. Now, that's good in some respects because SORNA, as we saw in Doe's versus Snyder and the briefing at the Supreme Court level, which ultimately denied certiorari after telling the Solicitor General of the United States to file a brief. And they filed a brief and said, we think you should deny cert because SORNA, the federal law, doesn't require the states to have these onerous things that they put in 2006 and 2011, like public registries and residence and presence restrictions and all of the worst stuff. And the state, that undermined the state's argument that we have to do this or we're going to lose the federal funding. And they love that argument, you know. But if we could be confident that the federal treatment would be, on balance, less severe than the state treatment, that would be something to promote. But I'd like to see it done away with altogether, and I'm encouraged by the fact that
Let me jump in right here right now. And that goes back to what I stated earlier. Back in 2010-11, an original version of the bill very specifically said the alerts. It didn't talk about the unique identifier because that was not part of the bill. The alert would be based upon SORNA, not state law. So the Angel Watch would send an alert based upon your conviction and how it applied to SORNA. So if, for example, mine is CP, that's 10 years. Some states it's lifetime, other states it's 10 years. And you can be registered. If they simply applied SORNA, then there would not be a due process issue. I actually got an email from one of the women who actually helped write the bill, and I asked her why did they change that aspect of law, because that makes it really, really more onerous. It's usually more onerous because there are people that can get off after 15 years. After 10 years and not have the alert sent. And she stated, you have to realize, this is interesting, you have to realize that the office is manned by only one person 24/7, and basically they don't have time to check the conviction against SORNA. That's why they went with just a blanket, if you have to register, it's against a minor, we'll send the alert. That's the simple reason, because they don't have the manpower to check the SORNA requirements. To me, that sounds like a bullshit answer. That's a bullshit.
Yeah, well, and it also shows it cuts against their idea that this is important and ought to be done. If they really thought it was that important, wouldn't they have enough people to man?
King, that requires funding. We would have to levy taxes, King. Now that's something that we're not proud to do. But we're winding our way toward the end of this hour. We've only got 5 minutes, so I'm going to ask you guys. Would you like to do another segment on the other side of this hour, or would we like to schedule another IML segment? Because I can twist Andy for another half an hour. We can do a segment and take some calls. Do you guys want to hang over for any more time?
A segment isn't an hour.
A segment. We're going to do no more than a half hour.
I'll hang if y'all want to.
Okay. Paul, can you can? Well, then what we're going to do is we're going to wind down this here in about 3 minutes, and we'll take another break and let people stretch their legs and go to the bathroom. And the final segment will be primarily calls, because there's people out here that I'm sure would like to ask questions, and we're going to try to take a few calls. So we're actually 3 minutes away, so we got time to ask one more question. So who's next?
Well, I would be next. Do you guys know at RTAG which countries are actively turning people away?
Yes, there's a website. On my website, there's a matrix. It's registrantag.org, and there's a spreadsheet that shows the countries that are turning people away. So, I can summarize real quick if people are interested.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm sure Somalia isn't turning people away, but is a place like France or something like that turning people away?
All the Schengen countries, all of Europe at the moment is not a problem.
Really?
France, Germany, Italy, Spain, they're not a problem. England is a problem. Don't go to England. At least fly directly to it.
Do you have any idea why they would be that way?
I mean, each country has its own policies. England on this issue of child exportation is out of control. So is Ireland, and so is Australia. England, I got turned away. I was on my way to Ireland. Ireland now is turning people away. Why they are, I mean, like Mexico is out of control. I'd have to, you know, talk to the politicians and ask why. A lot of it's deference to our foreign policy. The other is just, because they get a message saying this person is a sex offender, child sex offender, and they're interpreting it as a child rapist. So that's the biggest issue. But all of Europe at the moment, Europe has basically decided that this issue is the Five Eyes, United States, England, and Australia especially, have taken this child exploitation thing way out of control, and the United States even further. Other countries like Philippines and Mexico, we're trying to engage with as RTAG to try to educate them on the fact that we've got it out of control and see if we can ameliorate some of the negative effects of the Angel Watch program.
So I don't think we have time for another question because we're gonna be hearing music here any second. Andy, do you have the energy to do this one half hour more before commit to it? Okay. So, ladies and gentlemen, we are going to concentrate on your phone calls in the next segment, and we will take as many as we possibly can. It's going to be on the topic of international Megan's Law. Please, the other topics have gone by, but we are going to do a session of Can They Do That? As soon as I can rope one of my favorite attorneys like King or Catherine Stroll or one of those to a convenient day, we're going to come back and do Can They Do That? People love that. So we're going to take your questions about things that are being done and can they be done lawfully and would there be a viable challenge? So that's going to wrap it up. Do you want to ship us off to the break, Andy?
I will run it right now.
It says you are listening to NARSL in Action and Registry Matters. So welcome back, everyone, to the Marcel in Action Overtime segment. And we're going to do a lightning round of phone calls. If you have a question, star six, and we will get to you as many as we can. We're going to make this as short as we can, no more than a half hour, but it might even be quicker depending on, we've done such a fine job, there might not be any questions. There's only one in the queue right now. And he's been there for a while, so star six should get you in the queue to ask a question.
Yeah, and that one is left over from prior.
Well, he must have gotten back in the queue because we didn't take care of him. So let's go ahead and get this segment rolling. And I'm going to do our little disclaimer that we always do when we've got attorneys. Keep in mind, responses provided on the program are merely intended to offer guidance and should not be construed as legal advice by NARSL. We cannot cover the specifics of any individual situation sufficiently to know what the most prudent course of action is. So NARSL advises all participants to consult with an attorney in your jurisdiction to determine whether there may be a viable cause of action. This advice is worth about what Handle on the Law's advice is worth if you listen to that program. So having said that, let's go to phone calls. King, you love that show, don't you?
Oh, yes. Yeah, it's carried in my market. And I would add to your boilerplate there, it shouldn't be construed as legal advice by NARSL, nor should be construed as legal advice by any lawyer who happens to have been talked into coming on by NARSL.
That goes for, I didn't do the disclaimer, but the recommendations by registered travel RTAG, those are their recommendations, and they do not necessarily reflect the recommendations of NARSL or its management. Okay, so here we go. South Carolina, you're on NARSL in Action. Go ahead.
Thank you, Larry. There was a comment made early in the segment that I think I heard, and I want to try to get clarification or some additional help on this. And that was, if they're revoking your passport, I thought I heard somebody say that they are required to give you 21 days notice before they revoke your passport. Did I hear that correctly, or am I mixing it up with something else?
I can answer that. No, what they're doing is they're simply stating that before they revoke it, they're required to send you a letter stating that they will be revoking it. There's no time frame associated with it. The 21 days is simply the 21 days required for you to notify them of travel for your international travel.
Okay, so there's no established lead time for how much in advance of the revocation notify you?
There's none established in the law, and I've had two different conversations with State Department representatives, and I don't want to throw stones, but they have no clue of how they're going to administer it. So I think they're just kind of moving forward and administering it in whatever way they can. But they are required by the statute to notify you first that they're going to revoke it before they revoke it. But that notification is only by letter, and there's no time frame as to when they send the letter and when you can expect it to be revoked.
Is that stipulation in IML or is it in some other element of the code?
It's in IML. It's specific language in HR 515.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Don. Okay, that was relatively quick. And we're going to go to the Metroplex, area code 817. You are on NARSL in Action. Go ahead.
Hi, we're actually from Texas, too, and that's just
the
actually
Metroplex.
Went through all the...
Dallas, Fort Worth.
Yeah, exactly. North of Dallas. But anyway, so we recently went over to Germany, and we didn't have problems, but we thought we might, but we were afraid of that the whole time. So like you said, it's hard to get back into a regular lifestyle with these hanging over your head and everything. But the question I have, I guess, is kind of, isn't some of this, you keep saying it's unconstitutional, and I've been looking up some amendments and things like that of the Constitution, and doesn't the Fifth Amendment apply to this? Because it's actually a due process issue, and it's also double jeopardy because they're retrying people without a trial.
Want me to take that?
Sure, King. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, you're correct that as vis-a-vis the federal government, the due process clause of the Fifth Amendment would apply. The 14th Amendment also has a due process clause, but that's the one that applies to the states and through which many of the federal rights were applied to as restrictions on state power. Does that make it unconstitutional is a lot different proposition. Federal power is great, and when it comes to matters of state, which this comes under because it is the fact the suit we were discussing that was dismissed in California was against the Department of State, which administers these things. But I'm very interested in the other thing you said about the double jeopardy clause. It wouldn't be that because, and their argument always is, well, registration is not punishment. Now, we have the Sixth Circuit now in Doe's versus Snyder, which is cert denied by the U.S. Supreme Court, saying that some of this stuff really is punitive, that's comparable to the ancient punishment of banishment or like the locking someone in stocks in the public square to be publicly shamed and have tomatoes thrown at them. The scarlet letter, so to speak. A lot of it is that, but we're not really there yet. That's something that's going to have to be fought one federal circuit at a time. But I am given heart by the parenthetical paragraph that is in, again, I'm going to refer to the Packingham case from last year, which really was groundbreaking. But its holding had to do with First Amendment association and speech. But there was a parenthetical paragraph in there in which they said, the majority of five, said that we find it, and I'm just paraphrasing, disturbing that these onerous requirements and prohibitions are placed on people who have already completely served their entire sentences without any fine individualized finding of actual dangerousness. However, that's not before the court at this time. You know, so and that's right. It wasn't the issue in the case, but that gives me heart that I don't know if that majority changes because we've changed the Supreme Court justice, or we're about to right now. And so, go ahead.
It could. I mean, it could swing it a different direction in some ways. You know, I don't know if it'll be more conservative or not, but you know,
there's no doubt it'll be more conservative.
And whether the same five who said that would actually rule in favor of plaintiffs if the thing actually was in front of them can't really be counted on. But that's a little bone that they threw us, and I think it's an invitation to put those issues before the Supreme Court. They denied certiorari in Doe versus Snyder because Snyder versus Doe at the Supreme Court level, because by doing nothing, they let the victory that those six plaintiffs had remain in place. If it were the other way around in some other circuit, and the litigants were making a strong argument that the rule should be same for the whole country as it is in the Sixth Circuit, that might be when we have a chance to see them do something. Would they go so far as to say that it's actually implicating the double jeopardy clause, as if you're actually going to be put in jeopardy of your liberty for the second time for the same offense or after being tried once? You know, I don't know if double jeopardy goes that far, but if they did find that it was punishment and that you had already served all your punishment and here they want to punish you again, then yes, I think double jeopardy is where you go.
That's a great question. Well, thank you very much.
Well, I have another caveat to that though, but if they're taking away all your liberties when you're out, you can't find places to live, you can't find a job, you can't go on vacation now because you can't go out of the United States to most countries. You know, they're pretty much taking away all your liberties. So I don't, there has to be a way to figure out a way to test that. You know, well,
We're working on that. There are cases that are out there moving through the system right now. There's the circuit case that we talked about earlier. There's the 11th Circuit case, McGuire versus Strange. That those very things are happening right now. The Sixth Circuit case, the Supreme Court could have chosen to hear that. They chose not to. So there, but we are doing the very thing you're saying. Those challenges are ongoing continuously.
That's right. That is a big part of what NARSOL is doing, and those are your membership dues at work.
Yes, but there's no one case going to bring down the registry, which is much chagrin when I say that, because registering people is not unconstitutional. We register voters, we register young men for the draft, we register school children, we register boats, cars, guns, you name it. So each registration scheme has to be analyzed on its merits to see if that particular scheme inflicts punishment. And if they go too far, like in Michigan, the Michigan legislature can come back and try to craft a less punitive scheme, and they start the whole process all over again. If we think that one's punitive, then we have to litigate against that one. The courts cannot tell the legislative bodies to stop legislating.
True.
So that is one of the reasons. Yeah. Go ahead.
I have a statement that Japanese were required to register before we set up the concentration camps. That was deemed to be unconstitutional. We also have to remember that Jews were required to register in Germany and in Poland before they set up those concentration camps. So we have to understand that registration in and of itself has had some legalities associated with it that have determined it to be either unconstitutional or violations of human rights.
Well, of what happened later, but the registration, merely registering people is not unconstitutional unless you're going to stop registering all the things I just named.
There was a Japanese individual in Seattle who, of course, it was after the war. His misdemeanor registration violation was overturned because it was deemed to be unconstitutional because it was a violation. It was a violation of constitutional protection. There's a case about that. It was a misdemeanor for not registering because you're a Japanese person.
Yes, well, we determined that the Supreme Court got that decision wrong when they upheld the executive on the internment. But if you want to believe that registration, all forms of registration are unconstitutional, that's fine. The courts are never going to agree with you, Paul, because registration in and of itself is not unconstitutional. So we're going to move on to the next caller. Thank you for that question from Dallas, from Denton. We're going to move to Oklahoma and the Oklahoma City area, probably in area code 405. Go ahead.
I just was curious because I've already purchased a passport a couple of years ago, and I was told the same thing, that it would last 10 years. And so I'm just out the money then and just have to eat the cost. And again, so that's unconstitutional too, or is it not unconstitutional?
I'm not sure.
I'm going to mute you because of the background noise. You got a lot of hum, but we'll answer your question. Okay, just keep listening. Okay, go ahead. That's the worst buzz I've ever heard.
Okay, who's the question for?
Anyone wants to take it. It's about he purchased a passport, and he's probably going to have to purchase another one, so there's cost involved in a reissuance of passport. The government's not eating that.
Yeah, but how much is involved? They might consider it kind of de minimis, but yeah, when the government takes something, you know, valuable from you, there is a takings clause in the Constitution, taking without just compensation. And if they pass a law after you paid for a 10-year passport, it seems like you ought to be able to get a replacement passport without being charged for it. I don't know that anyone has particularly raised the issue. Maybe Paul can address.
No one has, but the law was interesting. It specifically says it will be revoked, and if you want a new one, you're going to have to go back and spend the money to get a new one. And that's in the law. It seems to me that that covers what you just mentioned, as far as you know, unconstitutional provision. You know, for me, it's, you know, no one wants to spend $100, but you know, if we have to fight some battles, if he can get traction, that's great. But
well, I can tell you, I can tell you where he's probably thinking, Paul. Paul, he's probably thinking that since there's so many people out there, that this proverbial, why don't they just do a class action on this particular issue of all the people? And then when you combine the cumulative effect of all the of all these costs, then you've got a significant cause of action. The only problem is that they've been weakening these collective actions. They're, the conservative attitude is to force everybody to bring claims individually, whether it be against their employer for discrimination or whatever. They don't want this type of litigation. But I think that's where the caller might be thinking is that if it's not $100 for one person, it's not significant, but $100 for tens of thousands would be a significant amount of money and hassle.
Well,
Well, that's what I was thinking, and the fact that there's legislation that says, well, you lose your old passport and because we can cancel it because we've passed this subsequent law, and that if you want another one, even though you on a contract there, you'd say they entered a contract that you're going to have a 10-year passport for the money that you paid. I think that's a perfect class action, really, because the federal legislation can't overcome a constitutional provision such as the taking clause. We say that the Constitution is the supreme law of the land, and that is a flaw in the statute that that they would do that. And require people to pay all over again, whereas, and that's a difference. Had they're treating a person, there's also an equal protection, even though it's not a high standard because you're not a protected class, but you are someone who paid for something and you're not getting it, and the other person is. And the reason why the courts, other than just to suppress class actions, but not everything that where people there's commonality is going to be a class action, but when it's very limited set of facts and everybody has exactly the same damages for exactly the same reason, that is a perfect class action. And yes, it does get to be a lot of numbers.
So,
well,
that's
the circumstance. There's some 40,000 registrants who have passports. I mean, probably half of them might apply. So that's about $2 million. That might be a thorn in the State Department's side not to revoke them if they if they're going to not get money back for the administrative costs.
So,
right, and they get the attorney's fees besides because a class action comes with statutory attorney's fees, right, which can be more than the actual damages.
So we're going to try to
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
We're going to try to get the last group of callers on, and I'm going to ask for very quick questions because I don't want to hold people over past the time we agreed to. So this person's been on before. Let's go back. You're on Narsil in Action. Let's have a lightning round question.
Yeah, I just heard some information tonight I hadn't heard. I was turned away in the Dominican Republic, and after that I did some research. So I got my Irish passport, too, so I'm a dual citizen. Well, last year I decided to try and see how that worked, and I tried to go to Mexico. However, they were able to, I guess, cross-check it and refuse me in Mexico. Now, I heard tonight you had said that Ireland is one of the tough countries on the sex offenders. If I'm an Irish citizen now with an Irish passport, do you know whether they're allowed to reject you?
Generally, if you have a passport of a country, they will let you in. They will not turn you away. But again, it's up to the country. But generally, if you're a passport over of a country, they're going to let you transit into the country.
Do you know whether or not, that being said, and my plan was to be able to go to Ireland with that passport and then use the Irish passport around the rest of the world. Do you know whether or not that after you get out of the United States grip, whether or not they track you like they do here with the passports?
The answer is no. What will happen is when you depart or enter the United States, the manifest that you're on is released to the Border Patrol. That's one way they know that you travel. The other way is that you go and give your 21-day notice. So what people are doing is they'll travel to some place they can travel to, and then they'll travel on to other locations. And once you get to another country, they're not going to give that information to the U.S. government. Now, the question begs, what if you don't tell your registry if in your 21-day notice? All the Homeland Defense is telling us is that you're supposed to give all the information that you know, and you're not supposed to give false information. So what I recommend, again, as Larry says, I'm not a lawyer, what we recommend is go down, give your 21-day notice, let them know where you're traveling, and then go on your way. If you go someplace else while you're traveling, that's your business. That said, that is why they have the unique identifier. And we don't have any indication that the U.S. government's going to give a twat whether you travel to Ireland and then you fly on to Bangladesh. But realize that that will be in a passport that will be stamped when you come across. So right now, all we believe is that you have to give 21-day notice. Now, the website does say unless there's an emergency or other problems, you're supposed to give 21 days or immediate information notice. Anyway, you definitely have to tell them that you're traveling to Ireland and that you're supposed to give accurate information and all the information you know. That's what you need to do. After that, you can travel on your Irish passport without a problem.
Thank you for that question. I went ahead and he's still there, but he can't respond because I wanted to try to get these other people on, and we're running out of time. But I appreciate your question, and we will be doing other segments on International Megan's Law. This is a topic that's not going to go away. So we're going to go next to Grand Central Station. You're on Narsil in Action. Make it quick, please.
Yes, sorry. Yes, I'm very concerned about something I'd like to bring to your attention. My British lawyer from England was able to discover that Interpol sent inaccurate and false information to New York about my criminal history, and we are working on a legal case about that. They actually did not even write down, they did not send the New York Intelligence Center my actual conviction. They wrote a bunch of made up stuff actually to make me sound like I'm the most evil person in the universe, which is very shocking. Luckily in Europe, we have very strong data protection laws. So agencies like Interpol and for example, in the United Kingdom, the National Crime Agency, they have to provide us information on what they sent to America and what the American communications back were. I'm wondering, since my UK lawyer is very, basically he's got a barrister working on this, he's very concerned that I've been treated very unjustly, and he's very concerned about this false information being sent to America, where unfortunately, in New York, they believed everything false that was sent from the UK. I'm wondering how that affects me, because basically it's not only a breach of data, but a misuse of information and false facts. And also, I'd just like to quickly add, because I know there's other people on the line, a positive thing that we're dealing with is something called the right to be forgotten. And because my conviction is from Europe and not from America, because the state registry is a data controller, they have to remove under data, even though they're based in America, under the European general data regulations, they have to remove out-of-date, inaccurate, or false information. And the fact is, my conviction is not a current conviction. And actually, I am under a protected class in the United Kingdom, basically of a spent conviction, which is kind of like a expunged record for you guys, kind of similar to that.
So thank you. Is this my favorite person, Charles? Is this,
yes,
is this you, Charles?
It is.
Okay. Thank you for calling.
Yes, it is.
We had a great podcast about your question last week. Did you listen?
Yes, I did. Sorry, I wasn't able to attend. But I will tell you that the report, I've seen the report from the Interpol, And all they sent was a list of addresses. I lived in England, my fingerprints. And then they didn't even write, like I said, they didn't even write the conviction. It was very vague. And then they wrote a load of stuff that never even happened. It was just absolutely bizarre. And that's why I'm concerned about all this, you know, data transferring to country to country. And I really feel that, you know, just very quickly, because I know we're running out of time. Last year, I had to go to a hearing, waste loads of thousands of dollars just to prove to them that there was no plea deal and that the conviction is not an active conviction. And it's like, I'm sick of all this, that is, the burden is on me and I have to do all the work for them. They, you know, and it's just crazy because for me, I really believe New York doesn't, I don't think they properly understand foreign laws and I'm being kind of screwed over. And plus they received false facts. They received made up stuff and we're very concerned. And that's why we're working on a case in the United Kingdom. We're very concerned. And we also are going to try to get that stuff delisted off the website. But what's interesting, Larry, is that if I win that right to be forgotten, that New York State registry site will be delisted from Google. And that could actually affect the result in the United States version of Google, that registry, official New York State registry, potentially might not show up. So I'd like to see how they react to that. Because
we're very interested. This is by no means a lightning question. I don't know if we're going to be able to deal with it, but we're interested in the right to be forgotten because Europe is light years ahead of us on that in terms of that. I'm going to ask you to take whatever response and just listen, and I'm going to try to get to the other caller. Is that okay, Charles?
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks.
Thank
for
you very
question.
Much. Thank you.
Okay. Does anybody want to take a stab at that? He's one of our loyal supporters.
Well very quickly, this is King. Very quickly, false statements that are damaging are defamation, or in common law, American common law terms, if they're written, then they're if they're spoken, they're slander, and if they're written, they're libel. In Louisiana, there's no such distinction. And when the false statement is one that imputes a crime, then it is a defamation per se, and the benefit of defamation per se is that damages are presumed. So the damage claim wouldn't lie against New York. They believe something that they've been told by officials from the country of origin. The person who would be liable for that would be the one supplying the false information. And somebody should have some consequences for that. So I think you're right to have the English barrister working on that. But I think you have a better cause of action for that type of thing in the United States than you do in Britain, where free speech isn't as big a thing as it is in the United States.
So we've got one more call, and then we're going to wrap up so that you guys go ahead. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm from South Dakota. Do I understand from listening to you that if I have not heard, I want to go to Canada this summer, and I have never heard from any official saying that I cannot use my passport, no 21-day notice, does that mean I'm free to go? Is that the way I understood you? That's my question.
Well, you're free to go whenever you want. If you're a registrant in the United States in any jurisdiction, then you're going to have to give 21-day notice. If your offense was against a minor and you must register in the jurisdiction that you live, you will at some point possibly be required to have a unique identifier. That said, you are free to travel to Canada. However, I would suspect Canada, out of a matter of course, will turn you away at the border once they're informed about your status, unless in the future you can get what's called a letter of rehabilitation from Canadian immigration.
And Paul, my understanding is that the Canadians have full access to the NCIC, the Criminal Repository of the United States. So you might be discovered. It doesn't have to be a sex offense. It can be any crime will potentially bar you from admission to Canada because they believe in the Trump doctrine of extreme vetting of people who enter Canada. I'm gonna ask Paul. I apologize. We never can seem to have enough time. But do you have guys have any RTAG that is have any plans for any radical change of what we've been doing so far in terms of this battle that you want to share with the listeners before we conclude? What's RTAG doing
on
forward?
Yes. On the side of what we're doing right now is to support in every possible any litigation or that we attempt. But on the operational side, what we're doing is we're engaging individual countries, their immigration and justice departments, for example. We're engaging with a lawyer in Mexico to communicate with the Mexican Justice Department and their immigration on what they call the Guardian Angel Program. And we're also getting people who have been turned away file complaints with appropriate human rights courts, whether it's United Nations, the Latin Court, the Asian Court, or the European Court of Human Rights. And then we want to, in the long term, engage Congress. We have a relationship with a staffer who helped write the bill. I've just informed him of some of the challenges we've had, her. And then I would like to, in the future, see if we can go back and see if we can get modifications to the law to maybe at least comply with just SORNA. If we did that, we could drastically limit the number of people that alerts are sent on. So those are the three actions we're moving forward with on now. We have traction on some of them, but that would take another session to talk about.
And we'll do that, Paul. You're always welcome. We've kept kind of low profile on this issue because we didn't actually see exactly the same with the attorney team in California that was working on this, and we wanted to not be any way non-supportive of them in terms of what people would say we were not on the same team. We're on the same team. We think this is a horrible policy. It doesn't do anything for public benefit, and it's harming a lot of people in the process. The trick is how much we can do through the courts, and the litigation strategy that they chose so far has been ineffective. We're hoping just to try to chip away with incrementally, like Mr. Reingold talked about earlier with the whole registry. We think we may be able to put something on the table in the coming weeks that would attack a small aspect of this law. And then hopefully through the election process, we'll get people who will rethink who they voted for the last time around, and maybe we can get some. The reason why it never got out of Congress before is because you had key people in key committee who were in the majority at the time who would not let it out to the floor for a vote. If you ever let this stuff out to the floor, it will pass, and that's what happened. But on that note, we're going to thank Paul Rigney. We're going to thank you so much for being with us. King Alexander, thank you for being with us. All of the listeners are on YouTube. There's been some chatter that we haven't gotten to from most of you guys. Thank you, everybody. And we will be doing a Can They Do That in the next couple of weeks, and you'll receive notices of that. And good night, everybody, from Narsil. Until next time.